Well, good afternoon, everyone. I am Glenn Mitchell, and I know a lot of y'all, and some of you are new faces to me, but I coordinate the weekend poetry series sponsored here at the library by the Friends of the Library. And we attempt to invite, and we usually have 100% success in poets accepting our invitations, but we bring what we think are really the best poets in the world to Concord. We brought many internationally and nationally known poets, regionally known and emerging poets, and today we're bringing to Concord Ron Slate. And I am thrilled that I discovered Ron through a poet that many of us know and love as well as I do, and that's Louise Glick. When Louise read here just about a year ago, and I'm sure many of you were downstairs in the rotunda, I asked her who she would recommend that without fail I should invite, and she said Ron Slate. So here Ron is today. Afterwards, I hope people will all stay for some good cheer and conversation. I have some cookies and some cider over there, and we have volumes of both Ron's books that you might want to publish. Purchase, excuse me, if you haven't already, and some of the proceeds come back to the Friends. Well, I have a feeling a lot of this is going to be close to Newcastle because you already know so much about Ron, but let me say, for those of us that are not familiar with his background, what I think popped out for me that I want to share. He's born in Quincy. He's been living in Milton, I have a feeling, for quite a few years. He took his creative writing degree from Stanford University and then did doctoral work in American literature at the University of Wisconsin. And in those early years, he started and edited a poetry magazine, the Chowder Review, which it was published through 1988. And I'm hoping at some point we might find out more about what that meant to Ron in terms of his own writing career. You know, being an editor and being a writer are an interesting two paths that not too many people pursue concomitantly. In 1978, he left academia and was hired as a corporate speechwriter, beginning his business career in communications and marketing. And from 94 through 2001, he was the vice president of global communications for EMC, that computer giant, and traveled the world. More recently, he was chief operating officer of a biotech life sciences startup firm, and he's also co-founded a social network for family caregivers. Needless to say, he's been widely published in all of the major poetry periodicals, including such as Antaeus, the Georgia Review, and Poetry Northwest. And I can't not tell you about his remarkable website on the seawall, which you can access at ronslate.com. It has an amazing library of reviews that he's written on poets, authors, biographers from around the world, and it's quite an education in itself. It's become one of my favorite places to go on the web. Ron's first book, Incentive of the Maggot, was written about 20-odd years after leaving Stanford and departing his global travels with EMC. For this work, he received the Breadloaf Conference's Bakeless Prize, which is awarded for the best first book manuscript. Former poet laureate Robert Pinsky, who's also read here at the library, has called those poems muscular, ironic, and informed. And that book went on to be nominated for two of the nation's most prestigious prizes, the National Book Critics Circle Poetry Prize and the Lenore Marshall Prize of the Academy of American Poets. About his second book, The Great Wave, Gail Mazur, a poet who's also read here, has said this: with linguistic precision and hard-earned objectivity, the poems in Great Wave are paradoxically fabular and firmly situated in worldly reality. Slate is at once a realist, uneasily inhabiting a staggeringly surreal universe, and a sophisticated surrealist, moving easily inside the ordinary life of family, corporate work, and international travel, interpreting his disjointed surroundings with gravity and clarity. And I'd like to end by reading you one of the additional insightful comments from Publishers Weekly, who said, "Slate seeks and often finds a classical simplicity, not to be confused with simplification. His deliberate pace, his mergers of disillusion with an almost, but not quite, religious poise, and his interpolated travelogues might put careful readers in mind of Robert Haas." Well, without further ado, let's all warmly welcome Bronn Slate to Concord.
Thanks. Glenn asked me to talk about the backstories of the poems I'm going to read, and normally I don't say too much about the poems because it's hard to listen to poems in the first place. So one wants to read slowly. You don't get a chance to go back and to see the words again. So a lot. When I sit in the audience and go to poetry readings, a lot of it just goes over my head if it doesn't happen slowly enough. And so just for time's sake, I don't usually say too much about the poems, but there's a poet named August Kleinzahler, lives in San Francisco, publishing a lot right now, and he said just the other day, in fact, that about 90% of what he has in his poems is based on things that he has actually seen. And then I read something by Richard Wilbur. This goes back 15 years, but he said he could think of only one poem he had written based on something he had seen. So the life of the poet and the voice of the poet are really not very important. We can't really look through the poem to see the world, because the poem insists on being a separate thing. I worked in an office in Waltham for 5 years, about a mile from the campus of Brandeis, and my wife was doing graduate work there. And I liked to go to campus and wander around, and I went over there, and I was going to the library, and there was a young man walking towards me, and he wearing a t-shirt, and the t-shirt said, "Dead poets don't give readings." And as he walked by, I turned to look, and on the back of his shirt was a picture of Walt Whitman, the famous picture, one of the famous ones, the bearded poet. And we think we have one recording of Walt Whitman reading towards the end of his life. He doesn't sound at all like what we might have imagined him to sound like. It goes back to the point I made, which is that we don't really need my voice at all. So what is the benefit of my reading? Well, poetry readings become events. You know, it's an event. And actually, what I'm going to try to do is to detach myself from the work so that perhaps you can hear it. And the things I will add will be to try to clarify certain things in the poems that you just won't have a chance to go back and look at again. So the first poem is called "Writing Off Argentina." And it's true that I went to Argentina. I went to Argentina in 2000 because the company I was working for at the time, EMC, was sponsoring a major golf event there. And I left the company in June of 01 when the internet bubble burst. And that was a kind economic problem, because the whole economy didn't fall apart, just one sector of the economy. But down south in Argentina, the economy completely fell apart. The banks were closed. You couldn't get your money out of the bank. There was turmoil everywhere. And proud Argentina, even the word argent is in its name, money is in its name, fell apart. And this poem is called "Writing Off Argentina." It mentions Jorge Luis Borges, the greatest writer of the 20th century, not to receive the Nobel Prize, writing off Argentina. This morning, the peso is free-floating above the unstable world of Borges. He knew Buenos Aires was not a city to die in. Geneva was that much closer to the other world. When the system fails, the theory of the system becomes pure. And the housewives of Buenos Aires gather outside Congress and bang their pots and pans. And their husbands gather outside the courthouse and jangle their car keys, proudly to ask, "What have you done to our good life?" Brazilian joke. Why do Argentines run outdoors when there's lightning? Because they think God is taking their photograph. Borges asked, "What man has never felt that he has lost something infinite?" When the economy falls apart, you feel that loss. Plus, your pesos deflate, to illustrate. Yesterday, on the Avenida Borges, we lived in this world. But what were we like? We took our dollars to buy leather coats at the shop of Esteban Umansky, who gave each of us a hat and gloves. The president himself attended our reception, and the ex-president, now under house arrest for the millions in his Swiss account. So the Argentines go to Switzerland to hoard and die. And we go to Buenos Aires to shop and live. When Borges went to Geneva to die, the Argentines thought it was some kind of poetic conceit. They were too cocky to see he had given up trying to express himself. Something great had been lost, some treasure. He had decided all men are benighted. This morning of the wrecked and plundered, I am all seeing, but my soul is blind. I feel very much like myself. In pursuit of a deal in leather, in pursuit of one's money in the shuttered banks, we are forgetting how to be decently unhappy. Learn from the global lenders, writing off their bad Argentine debts. Their dual wisdom. First, understanding the loss. Then, understanding there's nothing to be done. I understand, and I love my odorous coat. And Esteban made me a jacket as well at a price not to be believed. Poems call to each other. They live in a world apart. They live in a third world. When we think of the poet, we think the poet has memory, the poet has personal history, and then there's the outside world. But somewhere in the middle is the poem, and it insists on being a separate thing. And poems call to each other. And I know that you will remember a poem that appeared in The New Yorker just after the catastrophe in New York and at the Pentagon and in Pennsylvania. The poem was printed on the back page of The New Yorker by Zagajewski. And a Polish poet, translated by Claire Kavanaugh. It's called "Try to Praise the Mutilated World." And that poem, it's the only one I can recall ever be printed on the back page of The New Yorker, and it was printed in reverse, so it was white type on a black background. And I'm going to read that poem to you, and then I'm going to read a poem that I wrote in response to it. "Try to Praise the Mutilated World." Try to praise the mutilated world. Remember June's long days and wild strawberries, drops of wine, the dew, the nettles that methodically overgrow the abandoned homesteads of exiles. You must praise the mutilated world. You watched the stylish yachts and ships. One of them had a long trip ahead of it, while salty oblivion awaited others. You've seen the refugees heading nowhere. You've heard the executioners sing joyfully. You should praise the mutilated world. Remember the moments when we were together in a white room and the curtain fluttered. Return in thought to the concert where music flared. You gathered acorns in the park in autumn and leaves eddied over the earth's scars. Praise the mutilated world and the gray feather a thrush lost and the gentle light that strays and vanishes and returns. I remember turning on the radio just after 9/11 and Billy Collins, who was the poet laureate, was on the radio and he was saying that, and there was a lot of poetry being read, and he was saying that poetry is a great form of consolation. And I was thinking that I couldn't figure that out. I mean, it seems really obvious that it would be, because we can get right to human emotion in poetry. But I don't feel that one of the main functions of poetry is to console us. And I was thinking about Billy Collins, and I was thinking about try to praise the mutilated world, and then to catastrophes that I have known, famous catastrophes that I have known. And it seemed to me that it's possible to praise the mutilations a little bit too much. It's possible. And it was an unresolved thought, but I wrote this poem called Coconut Grove, and it's based on Coconut Grove fire in Boston, November 28th, 1942. 492 people were killed, most of them almost within a few minutes' time, most of them from smoke inhalation. And the 492 included my paternal grandmother and her sister, my great aunt. Coconut Grove. My life began with the fire, glimmering in the birth waters. Beyond my bedroom wall, voices murmured a memory. My father's mother died with her sister in the ladies' room. He said, if she had escaped to Chomet Street, been saved, nothing would be the way it is. How is it? Drifted over my route to school. I stared at a wire service photo fixed with brutal light, a fire hose snaking through soaked debris, faces slack with shock, bodies laid out on the sidewalk. How compelling for a family to have such a story to relate. Nothing would be the way it is. To speak of a desirable world, the listening boy leaning in. November in Boston, women collapsed waiting for their coats. The ceiling's satinette billows crackled and melted and were drawn into their throats, a shoe wedged in the revolving door. Face pressed against glass. The fireball, bright orange or bluish with a yellow cast or a blistering white. The nightclub burned in minutes in 1942 with a sibilant exhalation. My grandfather, sworn in, testified. But a single night evades judgment, bloated with unassignable blame. Corrosive worm of remembrance, a lure of the lurid past, the nozzle's snout regressing down the smoldering street. Adoring the damaged world, we abused it. We refused to let the sea wind clear the smoke. So now it's time to decide how to move within spaces on the sites of catastrophe, how to regard the atria and the lobbies, even as the alarms sound, evacuations rehearsed, the streets filling with imaginary survivors. Just as the boy surviving boyhood said, so that's how it is. Just before sleep settled on him like asbestos. One thing that you don't get to do when you're sitting there listening is to actually see the poetry laid out on the page, the length of lines, the breaks of lines, the jumping around, the patterns of words. This poem that I'm going to read, it's the only new one that I'm going to read, because it's the only one I consider done since my last book. It's called A Vigil. It has very long lines, so a poem like that you tend to read like prose, because it's pretty prosy. It has to do with a certain custom. The premise of this poem is that somebody is sitting with a person who has just died. And in the Jewish tradition, especially among Orthodox Jews, someone must always stay with the body until it is buried in order to make it easier for the soul and the spirit to pass from this life into the next. That's the explanation. So again, the premise is a man is sitting with a body, and the poem is called A Vigil. Soon it was my turn to sit with the body. They took away my navel orange and bottle of water, since to chew and swallow acts now impossible for the body, would mock when respect is most required. My cousins, the lawyers, were sorting through things in his apartment. Where's the will, the bank accounts, the insurance policy? He lived alone there for 25 years. His mother's wig in a drawer, her dress on a door hook, his father's clothes in the closet. He officially maintained the fiction of running an import distributorship in order to attend trade shows. Technology, machinery, medicine, toys, and candy. During the vigil, it is forbidden to fulfill a commandment, again, to avoid insulting the limited range of the dead. But I was remembering, surely a transgression. His place was stacked high with cartons of brochures. You could smell the mildewing paper and the demise of aging materials comprising the house. At the few family events he attended, he warned us of the rise of masses of people with grievances. Those who neither invent nor design nor build anything. Those who bloat from food stamps spent on corn chips. Those with no sense of history or culture. You distribute the wealth, he said, you end with Stalin. Boxes of free samples, many items no longer for sale, dried up ballpoints, baby foods, shoe polish. But from the weeping of dark young faces in the back rows of the funeral chapel, we learned he practiced his profession in a free dental clinic. His friends in the community center had come to mourn. My cousins found his checkbook and tax returns, his charity and modest assets. He owed little. There were no unstamped pages in his passport. He would talk at length to the disinterested or habitually polite about Chinese super high-speed non-shuttle fabric looms, the surpassing marvels, and then the cupidity of politicians. I could hear the growing din of drive time traffic through the walls. My thirst, my grumbling gut. How many years ago did I turn my face away from him? He wore a jacket and tie to dinner, but he was not so clean and kempt as his living space proved. If there's a man, there's a problem, said Stalin. No man, no problem. The next two poems are poems based on business, or rather, I should say, the departure from business. It's been since June of 08 since I've had a job. I'm officially out of the business life. And there are two poems here, one called Reunion, and the reunion in this case is not a school reunion, but a reunion of business people getting together to talk about the old times. My first book, The Incentive of the Maggot, is animated by the excitement of being able to write it all after not doing so for 20 years. My second book, The Great Wave, is more talky, to use a word that's been described to it by my teacher. And it has more to do with the question, what is it like to desire something in your mid-50s? What is desire when you hit your 50s? Now I'm 60. Reunion. I attended the reunion. Talk brisk, but diluted by time. A colleague raised his glass to praise me. His legacy here is legendary. Not one of us knows what I was like. News of former colleagues, vanished friends. This one was commended. That one was broken by onerous obligations. And she is dissatisfied, but no longer ill. Looking down six stories, I saw a woman approaching the office tower across the avenue, her right arm swinging, the other slightly bent at the elbow, in motion, yet not released, suggesting all that remains to be done. Next time I looked out the window, the darkness had taken the city below. There was the time in Sydney, in Barcelona, Sao Paulo, and Rome. Apparently, everywhere I went, I said and did remarkable things. Aloft, above cities, one encountered women with no taste for nonsense. I told a lady in Amsterdam I was an astronaut. She said, "You're too small." I said, "This is an advantage in a capsule." Crude forsakings of faces and cities. The memory of my farewells makes me sad. Their wordplay, so much charm, but not much else. Yet I lived in a larger world. My worries, paltry and ridiculous, disappeared in dialogue. And then I was alone and pleasantly spent. Of our buildings, corridors, and movable walls, what I recall is a slender wrist and hand reaching for a slice of toast sliding down the exit ramp of the toaster. The cafeteria, a place of suspensions, surprising postures, and revelations. I was adept at envisioning a world of invention and speed, then swiftly abandoning it for another, until it seemed no great matter to enter the world, to think you are entering, earning, providing. At the revolving door of the office tower, she paused. An extraordinary act, a woman stopping cold like that, making me a stranger to our past. And this second business poem is called Final Trip. And the premise of the poem is that a business person goes out to make one last trip on the road. In this case, it's to Japan and then to Italy and then home. I think the rest is self-explanatory. Final trip. I had a Japanese colleague who drove me at 4 a.m. from Tokyo along the coast to Kujikurahama Beach to witness the advent of the Festival of the Dead as a gift, since this trip would be my last. There were mounds of black volcanic sand, holes pitting the expanse, and within each hole, a small boy curled like a shrimp. Then the sun rose, and the boys awoke, scanning the east for the ancestral barges to hail the dead for a three-day visit. The ardor of hope for the afterlife. Hearing Christians talk of it on TV makes me uneasy. That they should be so taken. Yet once I also counted on everlasting life. The next week, my Italian manager sent me up to Borgo San Sepolcro to look at the Resurrection by Piero della Francesca. While four soldiers sleep, Christ pauses, one foot up on the sarcophagus, gazing not at us, but through us. In the world, I was known as a touring overseer with a universal phone, in the habit of speaking fraternally, but actually quite formally, with my local friends. So I had to wonder why they wanted me to see these things. Soon the boys on the beach began their walk home, leading their invisible forebears. The traditional foods of Chiba Prefecture, dried apples, beans and chestnuts, clams, the blowfish called fugu, now come from China. A god staring through me. It's always uncertain whether I'm about to be punished, rewarded, or simply ignored. Returning to my office, I packed up the few things that didn't belong to the company. I can't recall the names of my colleagues. Faces drift out of the mind. Maybe that's how the afterlife arose. First, the difficulty of meeting the stranger, and then his disappearance into the thing he wants you to see. I think I'll read two more. This next poem is called Saturnesque. Saturn is the planet. And my parents, until recently, used to go to Sarasota, Florida, for the winter. For 4 months, they went and rented a place, and their condo was located 7 floors up above the beach, staring due west. And I was standing out there, and it was nighttime, and I looked out there, and I could see Saturn. I could see with my naked eye. I could see that it was Saturn. It was lopsided. You know, Saturn, it just looks like a strange-shaped star. You can tell that it's, especially when it's low on the horizon, right? So the premise of this poem is that a son and mother are standing on the balcony overlooking the ocean. And the poem is about their relationship. I probably didn't even have to say that. I mean, you put a son and a mother anywhere, and it's always about the relationship. And this poem references two things. One, the Spanish words, it uses the Spanish word desaparecidos, which means those who have disappeared. Those who have disappeared because of Allende in Chile, for instance. Those who have disappeared in Central America, desaparecidos. And also there's mention of a song called But Beautiful. It was written in 1947 by Jimmy Van Heusen and Johnny Burke. It's a traditional song that the Torch Singers sing. great vocalist, the American Songbook. It's in the American Songbook. And also, one other thing, the word faint is in the poem, but if you saw it on the page, you would see that it's spelled F-E-I-N-T. Saturnesque. The lopsided star twirls over the horizon, and a dolphin laughs at his shadow, since the shining is so gaudy. My mother and I stand on the balcony, high above the tropical sea, with the runway to Saturn spilling towards us. Once again, she says the sea is beautiful. Nothing induces peace like such a night. Then she sighs unevenly, and I think of a joke. Strung and splotched with lights, the cruise ship is embraced by a sea that shudders with love and aversion. Under the mirthful scorn of a capering god, one must faint, one must evade in the manner of a darting aquatic creature. The disappeared were lashed to railroad ties, then tipped into the sea from helicopters. But this night has no mournful allure. When El Presidente rises from bed like a parent, nothing may be hidden from him. His people don't want to be understood, they want privacy. My mother, as a girl, tumbled over the handlebars into a roadside ditch, bullets ripping down the road. Then she hoisted herself above the world. Although sharp things flung about the galaxy and circled in taunting bands of debris, she could be found at night, buoyed by Jack Benny. I think of her singing But Beautiful as if she hadn't decided to disintegrate, as if Ella Fitzgerald had come to clean her house. When the dark tides rose, no one could reach her, except harshly. How far I am from what I'd cure with words. Yet I welcome this blithe drift away, what's seen in a quick squint, and the crazing, shattering path gleaming back. I think that to end, I'll read The Great Wave, the title poem from my book, and it's based on the tsunami that occurred on January 3rd, 2005. It's a persona poem. I remember staring at this picture of this young man named Rizal Shakputra, age 23. This guy floated out to sea 100 nautical miles off the tip of Sumatra. He spent 8 days at sea. He's floating around on flotsam and jetsam until he was picked up. And there was a picture of him on CNN.com, which I printed out and I had it on my desk for a while. And so came this poem. The Great Wave. I predict, like the one who was sucked to sea and returned in an Arabian container ship, all small worlds will be dashed and drowned. I witnessed this deliverance on a silent television. My fingers disquieted a bowl of almonds. A librarian called to say, Constantinople is on hold. The entire surface trembled, an oscillation like a bell. When the seismologist said the Eurasian plate delivered a blow to our planet, his words were almost enough to renew our belief in the Earth's roundness, the tidal sugars and salts of our bodies, the atonement of death squads. When I was a child, I discovered my depravity among the other boys. But we were sanguine all the same, with a fortitude to face what we'd found. So now, led to abandon the world for word of the world's moments, one must be cautious and deliberate. I had a dream. High water marks on the side of my house, the aftermath of a deluge rising from a spring in the cellar. I didn't realize the floodwaters would recede with the violence of their rising. Fishing boats torn from moorings, dome of the mosque collapsed. You who savor the scent of the linden live in a small world, and I also speak from a cramped provisional space. On the stacked ship, they videotaped as they passed, then circled back to pluck a single man from floating debris. I witnessed this alone on a glowing screen. I couldn't lift an almond to my mouth. I was a fallow field ruined by brackish flood. But I would choose the wave over the wind. I would swamp your world with wreckage. I would hold fast to you, and you would be saved.